You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Tuesday, July 5th, 2022. I'm Jackson Bird. Today, could the historic flooding at Yellowstone National Park be a positive thing in the long term? Plus, new findings into long COVID-caused brain fog, and why some movie theaters are banning formal attire. Here's some cool stuff for your ride home. This year was supposed to be a celebratory year for our nation's first national park. Yellowstone turns 150 this year. A few months ago, I told you about their Inheritance Pass, an annual park pass that won't be valid until 2172. So the whole point is you have to pass it down to someone, and that your donation will help conservation efforts to ensure the park is still around and able to be enjoyed by the people of the 2170s. But historic flooding 3 weeks ago caused the park to evacuate over 10,000 visitors and close all entrances. While some parts of the park reopened in a matter of days, other parts may not open all summer, putting a severe dent in tourist revenue for the park itself and the surrounding communities during peak travel time, to say nothing of the people whose homes and businesses were also destroyed in the floods. Cleanup and recovery efforts have been extensive, and especially with lost income this summer, are likely to drag on. But one conservation writer, S.J. Keller at National Geographic, dared to ask, could these floods actually be good for Yellowstone? It's an intriguing question, and one I sort of think about frequently when it comes to the climate crisis. You know, so often when people talk about the impending end of the world, what they're really talking about is the end of humanity. Now, granted, we're taking a lot of other species down with us and basically built our own doomed destiny, but the planet is going to keep going for quite a while after we're gone, and for some of that time, there will continue to be other life forms here, at least in certain hypothetical scenarios. So, abandoning human-first kind of thinking, Keller wondered, could the recent flooding in Yellowstone actually be restorative for the park? Scott Boss, the director of American River's Northern Rockies office, seemed to agree, telling National Geographic, quote, "As humans, we often think that floods are disastrous and fires are disastrous, but they're really only disastrous because we put human lives and property in harm's way. They're not disastrous from an ecological standpoint. Quite the contrary, they're extremely healthy for rivers, and especially for a river like the Yellowstone," end quote. But to back up, what caused the flooding at Yellowstone last month? Quoting longtime Yellowstone resident and Stanford University professor of environmental biology Liz Hadley in an interview with Futurity, quote, "Warmer temperatures and earlier snowmelt are causing peak runoff on the Yellowstone River to occur earlier in the year. On top of that, the park had an unusually late, heavy snowfall. The weather then quickly warmed and accelerated snowmelt. When we saw an atmospheric river bring massive amounts of rain into the area, snowmelt intensified. The combined result was the massive flooding we witnessed," end quote. But when rivers run up on their floodplains, rebelling against any human-created water diversions, magical transformations can sometimes occur, in the long run, and contrary to what humans' plans for the area may have been. And now that flooding has allowed the Yellowstone River to go rogue, we may see changes to the landscape. Geologist Karen Boyd says a lot of that will come from erosion, a negative-sounding word that can actually have interesting and potentially positive effects, partially through getting hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of sediment into the river. Quoting National Geographic, "Over time, as things like piles of downed trees snarled up in the river channel and on banks capture sediment, they grow into sandbars or islands. Eventually, willows and cottonwoods can gain a toehold on that freshly built land and create new animal habitat," End quote. Cottonwood trees are a particularly interesting case study that Keller focused on. They're super drought sensitive, so they require a lot of water. And Keller notes that 1.36 million of the 1.37 million cottonwood trees along the Lamar and Gardner rivers and the Soda Butte Creek in the park were established after the floods of 1995 and 1997. The initial flooding dampened the soil, allowing the seeds to germinate, and subsequent years of flooding gave the saplings enough hydration to keep growing. So it's not a given that this flood will cause a whole new generation of cottonwoods in the park. You know, for one, like I just said, they'd benefit best from another year of floods or substantial rains. And some are worried we'll be seeing just as much, if not more, drought in the area in the future. But Colorado State University ecologist David Cooper also told National Geographic that the cottonwoods in Yellowstone have been picked over too heavily by all the elk and bison. So there might not be enough seeds flying around to land in the newly wet soil and grow into trees. And even if they do start growing, they might get munched on before they fully mature. But maybe the elks, bison, and other grazing mammals will have enough other plants to keep their bellies full. Thanks to the snowmelt and extra rain, plants all over the park are thriving. And especially with less human visitors in their way, the herbivores are exploring far and wide, snacking on an abundance of plants. And Keller says some biologists are excited to see how animals might use the northern part of the park that's remaining closed without human interference. And watching how they use the park and how this latest bout of flooding changes the landscape could inform how the park rebuilds. Some would like to see any rebuilt infrastructure also redesigned so it's less susceptible to future flooding. That will happen and probably will get worse. But also so that it's more beneficial to the ecosystem overall. In particular, some would like to see the river stay wild and not be diverted by concrete chutes and the like. And another species that enjoys the chaos and complexity of wild rivers and flooding is trout. Particularly the Yellowstone cutthroat trout that's native to the area. The action of the flood allows them to escape to calmer tributaries to spawn, and lots of insects and other invertebrates get swept up in the floods, providing the trout and other species with plenty to eat. So good news for the trout in the short term, less good news when savvy fishermen arrive in 3 years to take advantage of the population boom. Former state fisheries biologist Pat Byroth told National Geographic, quote, "Everything in our ecosystem, and especially in the park, relies on this kind of refreshment to propagate itself in the long term. This is a complete remodel of the aquatic ecosystem, and it's a beautiful thing." End quote. Now, I don't want to undermine the hardship that the region has experienced and will continue to as they rebuild, but for the natural ecosystem and many of the animals, it's possible these floods will prove to be more restorative than destructive. As Keller put it, quote, "As they flood, wild, undammed rivers like the Yellowstone and its tributaries do something humans tend to resist. They change. In wild rivers, fast-moving water seeks out new channels, carries soil and gravel downstream, and spreads it across floodplains, reshaping the terrain. What may look like destruction to an angler used to casting a fly from a favorite sandbar, a boater accustomed to taking a particular side channel, or a landowner whose property line shifted, is in fact a sign that a river and its floodplain are vibrant and alive." End quote. Brain fog. It's a term people have increasingly been using over the years to refer to a sort of mental cloudiness, not quite fatigue that makes it difficult to focus, especially on more complex tasks. And while it's not an official medical condition, people report some sort of brain fogginess as a result of anything from stress to pregnancy to the flu to various chronic disabilities, and more recently, as a prime symptom of long COVID. Now, there is so much about long COVID that we are yet to understand. For some people, it lasts a few weeks after they've otherwise recovered from the disease. For others, a few months. Some have been experiencing lingering symptoms for years at this point, and I'm sure it will be a long time before we really have more solid answers, before we understand just how many people are afflicted with long COVID, the various ways that it manifests, why some people seem to get it while others don't, and what the lifelong effects of it may be on a person, or on us as a society. But one symptom, brain fog, has gotten the first blush of an explanation thanks to new research published last month in the journal Cell. Co-lead Stanford University neuro-oncologist Michelle Magna has spent 2 decades studying chemotherapy-induced cognitive symptoms, which are informally referred to as chemo fog. As Wired reports, when Magna first heard about COVID-19 being a major immune-activating virus, she hypothesized it could cause a similar chemo fog-like symptom. And soon enough, reports started emerging that confirmed her hypothesis. She told Wired, quote, "It really clinically looks just like the chemo fog that people experienced and that we'd been studying," end quote. So she teamed up with Yale immunologist Akiko Iwasaki to study mice infected with COVID-19 and how the virus disrupted the normal activity in parts of their brains and caused inflammation. Quoting Wired, "Once the mice had been infected with the virus, the scientists assessed the levels of cytokines in their blood and cerebrospinal fluid, the liquid surrounding the brain, at 7 days and 7 weeks after infection. Cytokines are markers secreted by the immune system, and they're critical in regulating inflammation. Not only were certain cytokines elevated in the cerebrospinal fluid at both time periods, but the scientists saw an increase of microglia reactivity in the subcortical white matter of the brain, the squishy white tissue rife with nerve fibers that makes up over half of the brain's volume. That was another sign of potential trouble. Microglia are sort of like the central nervous system's hungry scavengers. They're immune cells that clean up the brain by chomping on dead and unwanted neural debris, among other important functions. In response to stimuli, microglia can become perpetually reactive. One consequence is that they can begin eating away at needed neurons or other brain cells, which further disrupts the brain's homeostasis. In the case of COVID-19, the scientists found that this reactivity persisted even at 7 weeks after infection. Magna's team had seen similar elevation in this activity following chemotherapy and in brain samples from human patients who were infected with COVID-19. In the hippocampus, the area of the brain closely associated with memory, this overenthusiastic cleanup effort can deter the creation of new neurons, which are linked to maintaining healthy memory. End quote. But what causes the microglia to become reactive? The research team found it was a factor called CCL11, which was at elevated levels in the cytokines and which can decrease neuron generation and impair learning and memory. The team also looked into brain cells called myelinating oligodendrocytes, which generate the myelin padding around neurons, facilitating interneuron communication. Now, loss of this myelin in mice undergoing chemo had already been found by Magna's lab to have a direct connection to short-term memory and attention impairment. They ran the test on mice with mild COVID-19 infections and found almost the same proportion of mice having lost myelin as they did in the chemo study. So where do we go from here? Hopefully, these findings will help us begin to identify treatments that can be used for humans experiencing chemo fog or brain fog. And maybe we'll also come up with a different name for brain fog because, as UC San Francisco cognitive neurologist Joanna Helmuth told Wired, quote, "Brain fog is a colloquial term, and it kind of delegitimizes people's having a neurological disorder," end quote. Fresh off Disney's Lightyear's failure to launch, Universal's Minions: The Rise of Gru has just smashed box office records. Not only did it succeed where Lightyear failed in getting families back to the physical movie theaters this summer after many years of watching streaming releases at home, but the new Minions flick just became the biggest July 4th opening box office movie in history at $125.2 million in North America alone. Now, Lightyear had a ton of problems, according to critics, but I still maintain a big one was that Disney and Pixar released so many movies straight to Disney Plus over the last 2 years, and they didn't do a good enough job emphasizing that this one would only be in theaters. Yeah, I was following the press tour for that movie pretty closely and still didn't even realize that it wasn't going to be on Disney Plus immediately. I mean, I probably would have made plans to go see it in theaters had I realized it was only in theaters. And I'm sure I'm not alone. I became conditioned into thinking that all Pixar movies went straight to Disney Plus these days. So personally, I think that affected the box office at least a little bit. But I digress. The Minions have achieved world domination once again. But was it families all knowing their only shot at seeing the latest Minions movie was in physical cinemas? Or was it a semi-ironic TikTok trend? Gentle Minions. Teenagers dressed in suits going to see the kids' movie in large groups were ubiquitous at screenings around the world over the weekend, becoming such a big and in some cases distracting presence that several theaters in North America and the United Kingdom have banned any teenagers dressed in suits from buying tickets to Minions: The Rise of Gru. Now, teenagers dressing up to go to movies they might not otherwise be interested in is not a new phenomenon. My friends and I did that all the time growing up, especially when midnight releases were really big. You know, like, did I really care about the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie? No. But was it a fun excuse to get dressed up as a pirate with a dozen of my friends? Absolutely. The thing is, these gentle minions are not just dressing in suits and then sitting quietly while they watch the movie. They seem to have immediately turned the movie into a kind of Rocky Horror Picture Show experience with choreographed responses and actions to different parts of the movie, from cheering and shouting at otherwise inappropriate times to throwing literal bananas at the screen. Some theaters have additionally accused these groups of other forms of vandalism, disruption, and abuse of staff. Much of it is additionally being filmed for their TikTok accounts, which of course eggs on the rowdy behavior. And the trouble is that at the end of the day, this is still a kids' movie, and a lot of families have said these groups of gentle minions have been so disruptive that they and their kids can't even hear or see the movie anymore, and theaters have been getting scores of refund requests from families walking out of the movie, which is what has really led to the bans at some theaters. But of course, it's a bit of a difficult ban to enforce. Most theaters opt for saying that large groups in formal attire will be refused entry for the Minions movie. One cinema in Cornwall said it would no longer admit, quote, unaccompanied children wearing suits, which I personally find funny because even though it's definitely a Gen Z trend, some of the dudes in the videos look like they could be full-on adults. One parent told local media that two preteens in his son's friend group got turned away from the movie because they just happened to be wearing white-collared shirts, and they were allowed in once a parent dropped off sweaters for them to put over their collared shirts, as if those sweaters are going to miraculously change their behavior. This is where it all starts getting a little ridiculous. That and the fact that it seems like plenty of folks participating in the Gentle Minions trend are doing so politely and without causing a stir. It's just, as usual, a few of the most vocal bad actors are ruining all the fun for everyone else. Bottom line, if you're planning to go see the new Minion movie this weekend, just be sure to dress down for the occasion. All right, well, that's going to be it from me for today. This show was produced by Ride Home Media. I'm Jackson Bird, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.